The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, I'm Doris Hyde for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Vision News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various websites, beginning with from acb.org, Louisiana withdraws from Texas versus Kennedy, posted July 24th. ACB is thrilled to announce that Louisiana is dropping out of the Texas versus Kennedy lawsuit. This lawsuit aims to weaken disability rights by attacking Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, as well as the Supreme Court's ruling in Olmstead versus LC. Now that Louisiana is withdrawing, only four states remain part of this lawsuit, fighting against the rights of people with disabilities to live and receive care in their communities. More than half of the nine states who filed the amended complaint earlier this year have dropped out so far. Congratulations to the Louisiana advocates who have worked tirelessly to get their state to drop out of this damaging lawsuit. If you live in one of the remaining states that are part of this case, ACB strongly encourages you to continue to contact your governor and your state attorney general to demand that they drop out. The remaining states are Alaska, Florida, Montana, and Texas. Below you will find the contact info for each office. Alaska Governor's Office, 907-465-3500. Alaska Attorney General's Office, 907-269-5100. Florida Governor's Office, 850-717-9337. Florida Attorney General's Office, 850-414-3300. Montana Governor's Office, 406-444-3111. Montana Attorney General's Office, 406-444-2026. Texas Governor's Office, 512-463-2000. Texas Attorney General's Office, 512-463-2100. From fightingblindness.org, Vision Walk Team Captain Boot Camp. Tips, tricks, and team spirit, your playbook for Vision Walk success. Webinar hosts Wednesday, August 12th, 2026 at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Kick off Vision Walk season with this session to help Vision Walk team captains strengthen their teams, boost supporter engagement, and achieve fundraising goals. The chapter of Fighting Blindness is the Triad Triangle chapter. Our local chapter has become a second family for me. We have fun together, support one another, and work jointly to educate, advocate for, and bring resources to fight to end blindness. Together we have picked blackberries, heard from scientists, thrown axes, met with low vision experts, and shared homemade cookies. Our annual Durham Bulls baseball game outing is a highlight of my summer. Our chapter has become an important part of my life. Tim O'Brien, chapter president. There is no contact information for him. Location, virtual. Our fall 2026 Vision Walk season is underway. Join us and make this year's Vision Walk your best yet. If you have any questions, please contact the Vision Walk team at visionwalk@fightingblindness.org. Please fill out the form below to register and receive the Zoom link for the webinar. And there's a form and a submit button. This is very early notice from AFB.org for their 2026 AFB Leadership Summit. One day, one voice, united. Monday, October 26, 2026, downtown Louisville, Marriott. About the summit. It is often said that the opportunity arrives when you least expect it. Economic uncertainty and changes to federally funded programs have created anxiety across the field of blindness and low vision. Rising inflation, cuts to local programs like public transit, and limited access to affordable housing have at all tightened the disability squeeze that has long existed for people who are blind or have low vision. At the same time, the rise of artificial intelligence, AI, is rapidly changing the way things have always been done, making it easy to feel unsure about what comes next. But what if our greatest opportunities come from times like these? Over the past year, AFB has been listening to our community and recognizing the need to come together and move beyond the traditional conference format. The 2026 AFB Leadership Summit is a focused one-day experience designed to define clear outcomes and bring greater clarity to our field. Register. Registration is now open for the 2026 AFB Leadership Summit. Take part in a day of collaboration that will transform ideas into action. Through facilitated discussions and shared deliberations, participants will help define priorities for the field and leave with tangible outcomes that can sustain momentum long after the summit concludes. Register now at the hot link. Sponsorship opportunities. Increase your visibility at one of the leading events in the blindness and low vision field while supporting the partnerships and conversations that turn ideas into action. Explore our 2026 AFB Leadership Summer sponsorship menu at the hot link to learn more about opportunities available. For questions pertaining to this year's sponsorships or to reserve your sponsorship package, contact our partners team at partners@afb.org. Download the 2026 sponsorship menu at the Hunt link. What to expect? An engaging, facilitated one-day leadership summit on Monday, October 26, bringing together more than 100 thought leaders, scholars, practitioners, educators, advocates, and allied stakeholders, all committed to listening, learning, and leading together. A platform for the field with clear deliverables that can help sustain momentum and drive progress beyond the summit. An evening awards reception recognizing those in our field who inspire us to keep moving forward. A week of connection. The summit marks the beginning of a full week of programming and celebrations in Louisville. Partner organizations, including the American Printing House for the Blind, APH, Hotlink, and the Council of Schools and Services for the Blind, COSB, Hotlink, will host their annual meetings. The week will also include a special APH launch party on October 27th, celebrating the opening of the DOT Experience Hotlink, a world-class museum working to change perspectives about blindness and disability. Stay connected. Sign up to receive event updates as they become available at that hotlink. From FightingBlindness.org, Foundation Fighting Blindness urges withdrawal of new federal funding rule to prioritize patient health. The Foundation Fighting Blindness is the world's leading private funder of research into inherited retinal diseases and dry age-related macular degeneration, dry AMD. Over 50 years of strategic investments, we have helped advance numerous scientific discoveries from the laboratory into clinical development, including research that ultimately contributed to the first FDA-approved gene therapy for an inherited disease. Our mission depends upon a strong partnership among private philanthropy, academic institutions, biotechnology companies, and federal research agencies. For patients living with blinding inherited retinal diseases and dry AMD, many of whom have no approved treatment and face irreversible vision loss, predictability in the federal research system directly affects whether promising therapies reach patients. The Office of Management and Budget's proposed rule, Regulations for Federal Financial Assistance, Hotlink, fundamentally alters the long-standing framework governing federal financial assistance in ways that would undermine the biomedical research enterprise, create substantial uncertainty for research institutions and patent organizations, and jeopardize the public-private partnerships that have driven decades of medical innovation. Because these changes will ultimately hurt patients awaiting new treatments to slow down or reverse vision loss, we respectfully urge OMB to preserve scientific peer review as the primary basis for awarding biomedical research grants. As written, the proposed rule would implement the following changes. Upend merit-based scientific review by authorizing additional political review of awards that have already undergone rigorous scientific evaluation and the ability to change agency priorities after completing the peer review process. Allow for ad hoc termination of awards, permitting agencies to terminate discretionary awards when they decide that doing so serves agency priorities or the national interest, instead of terminating awards based on scientific performance or recipient compliance. Weaken public-private research partnerships that drive rare disease research by introducing uncertainty into federal funding. Rare disease research typically has limited commercial incentives and instead relies on private investments, which in turn look to federal funding for certainty. put congressional funding for research at odds with presidential policy. It is unclear what happens when presidential priorities are not aligned with the funding Congress has already appropriated for disease-specific research programs. The proposed revisions represent some of the most significant changes to the federal grants framework in many years and would affect nearly every recipient of federal financial assistance. They carry implications for universities, nonprofits, patient advocacy organizations, research institutions, and federal agencies. Changes have the potential to disrupt ongoing clinical research involving patients and delay development of therapies for rare diseases, where only a handful of research programs may exist. Patients with inherited retinal diseases and dry AMD depend on a stable, predictable, and scientifically driven federal research enterprise. Given the major implications of the proposed rule, Foundation Fighting Blindness has submitted comments to OMB requesting that they withdraw the proposed rule and, if additional reforms are deemed necessary, engage stakeholders through a new rulemaking process that preserves merit-based scientific review, respects congressional intent, and strengthens, not weakens, the research ecosystem that is essential to delivering new therapies to patients. While the public comment submission period to the OMB rule is formally closed, there is still time to contact your elected representatives with concerns about how the proposed rule impacts the scientific enterprise and what it means for patients who rely on it to develop new treatments. Read full comments at the hot link. Disability Rights NC alerted us to the following article from theassemblync.com. The politics of a prison release settlement. As former Governor Roy Cooper runs for the U.S. Senate, Republicans have seized on a 2021 settlement that compelled state officials to reduce the pandemic-era prison population. Much of the political rhetoric over it has been misleading at best and false at worst. Article by Michael Hewlett, H-E-W-L-E-T-T, posted July 27th. On January 29, 2022, Terrell Brace shot into a Charlotte home and killed Elante Thompson, a computer science student with a young daughter. Republicans have argued that Thompson would still be alive had it not been for a February 2021 settlement then-Governor Roy Cooper reached with the ACLU of North Carolina and other advocacy groups to lower the prison population by at least 3,500 inmates to stop the spread of COVID-19 in crowded state facilities. Brace shot Thompson after serving a 24-month prison sentence for felony and misdemeanor assault charges. Cooper's critics allege that the settlement indiscriminately turned loose thousands of violent criminals like Brace, who then went on to commit other crimes. Cooper has repeatedly denied the charge, and his supporters point to the unique threat of COVID-19. More than 9,500 inmates had tested positive for the virus by the time the settlement was signed, and 47 had died. The settlement has become a major flashpoint as Cooper runs for an open U.S. Senate seat against Michael Whatley, former chair of the Republican National Committee and the state GOP, one of the highest-profile races in the country. Polls show Cooper ahead, though the gap appears to be narrowing. Your Insider's Guide to NC Politics. From budget wrangling to emerging legislation, our reporters deliver exclusive insights. A joint House-Senate subcommittee on prisons that state Republican leaders formed this spring to investigate the settlement had scheduled its first hearing for 1 p.m. Monday, but abruptly canceled it last Friday. Leslie Dismukes, the current secretary for the State Department of Adult Correction, and Orlando Rodriguez, the agency's general counsel, have been called to testify. Central to Republicans' argument is a May 7th New York Post analysis of the settlement that asserts nearly half of the inmates it released went on to commit new crimes, including 18 homicides. But a more careful look at the final full list of 4,455 inmates made public past February shows that narrative is misleading. A judge ordered the list sealed as part of the settlement agreement, and there was never a court order unsealing it. Senate leader Phil Berger obtained the list, which made its way to Fox News before the Department of Adult Correction released it to the media. There are no names on the list, only offender identification numbers. To find out more information about an inmate on the list, you have to plug the offender identification number into the prison's system online information portal. The Assembly's review of the full list finds it is inaccurate to say that all of these inmates were released early. Many were released on timelines unrelated to the pandemic or the settlement. Brace, for example, left prison on July 25, 2020 after serving his full minimum sentence, records show. He is one of 1,535 inmates on the list, marked as with an asterisk, noting that they committed alleged violations of post-release supervision, which typically runs 9 to 12 months. In cases like Brace's, prison officials decided not to send them back to prison to meet the settlement's goal of reducing overcrowding. In other words, these inmates weren't released because of the settlement, they just weren't sent back to prison. Even if Brace had returned to prison, he would have been released months before the 2022 shooting. Our analysis found that of the roughly 3,000 inmates who were released early because of the settlement, more than 90% would have been out by the end of 2021 anyway, by virtue of completing their sentences. The agreement allowed prison officials to let them out early through a variety of methods, awarding credits for things like good behavior to shave time off their sentences, releasing qualified nonviolent inmates to house arrest, and accelerating parole for eligible inmates serving life or long active sentences under a previous sentencing structure. The New York Post reported that the North Carolina Sentencing and Policy Advisory Commission calculated the recidivism rate based on at least 3,500 inmates. It didn't. The commission analyzed only a sample of 1,180 inmates released between February and June 2021, finding that 48% of them were rearrested within 2 years. That rate was slightly higher than that of inmates who were released that same year under normal procedures, the report said. The Post also reported incorrectly that inmates like Brace were released early. Cooper has pushed back on efforts to pin an alleged crime wave on his leadership. These blatant lies from Republicans have been fact-checked for months and found to be false, his spokesperson said in a statement. Watley spokesperson D.J. Griffin said in a statement that the candidate stands with Elante Thompson's mother, Deborah, who told the New York Post, "Why would you release somebody like that? They're already showing they're a gangster to society. You're going to release a menace on the street?" Griffin declined to answer additional questions. Given the intense rhetoric around the settlement, the Assembly decided to dig deeper on its origin and impact, as well as how it's been discussed in the course of the Senate campaign. A unique threat. As the spread of COVID-19 shut down much of the world in 2020, Cooper joined other governors in issuing stay-home orders. And as the medical system strained under spiking numbers of severe infections, leaders in the NC and many other states issued mask and social distancing mandates. Cooper gave daily updates about the state's efforts to contain the virus. Nearly 30,000 North Carolina residents have died due to the disease in the last 6 years. Public health experts noted that because of confined quarters and an inability to effect social distancing, incarcerated people are some of the most at risk for transmission. At Rikers Island in New York City, for example, one infection exploded into 200 in only 12 days. The first infection in a North Carolina prison was confirmed on April 1, 2020, at Halifax's Caledonia Correctional Institution, now known as Roanoke River Correctional Institution. Later that month, an outbreak at the new correctional institution in Goldsboro affected more than 400 inmates. There was no vaccine at that point, and medical experts were still scrambling to figure out treatments. Sandra Mariner, who was serving a life sentence for second-degree murder at Swannanoa Correctional Center for Women in Black Mountain, was paroled in March 2021 as part of the settlement. She was one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. But before then, she lived in fear of how fast the infections were spreading. She suffered from chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and high blood pressure, putting her at greater risk of dying from the virus. Prison officials tried to prevent inmates from interacting and handed each of them 3 1-ply cloth masks, she said. But it wasn't enough. She eventually became ill that fall. She believed she caught it from a caseworker. "I thought, I'm going to be one of the ones that it takes out," Mariner said. Luckily, it was a mild case. She had a fever and couldn't smell anything. She was let out of quarantine after twice testing negative, but dozens of others weren't as lucky. Early on, civil rights groups like the ACLU of North Carolina, Disability Rights North Carolina, and Emancipate NC began raising concerns about prison conditions. They urged leaders to take the virus more seriously and reduce the prison population, which at that point was near its 34,000 capacity. One-third of the state's inmates had a disability, and almost a quarter were over 50, making them even more vulnerable. The advocates noted, releasing some of them could help keep both other incarcerated individuals and prison staff who go home to their families each night safe. To not do so was a violation of their constitutional protections against cruel and unusual punishment, the advocates said. 5 or 6 years ago, we were all working with far less information than what we now have about COVID-19 and far fewer resources about how to respond to it, Corey Dunn, Director of Public Policy for Disability Rights North Carolina, told the Assembly. Those advocacy groups and several inmates filed suit against Cooper, then Secretary of Public Safety Eric Hooks, and other officials on April 20, 2020. They wanted a judge to force the Cooper administration to implement safety protocols, such as regular testing, and reduce the overall prison population to slow the spread. Without these measures, COVID-19 will be a death sentence for many incarcerated people, the lawsuit warned. On June 16th, Wake Superior Court Judge Vincent Rozier Jr. granted a preliminary injunction. Prison conditions were likely unconstitutional, Rozier concluded, and state officials needed to come up with a plan to reduce overcrowding, stop inmate transfers within the prison system, and adopt other safety protocols. Whatley himself criticized Cooper for not doing more about COVID in correctional settings at an event the following month, telling a group of fellow Republicans that the governor did not act to protect folks in prison, so we now have a significant spike among the prison population as well as prison guards. The state GOP also issued a news release saying that Cooper only took the prison situation seriously when a judge ordered him to. Charlotte news station WSOC-TV reported on Whatley's 2020 comments earlier this month, which led Whatley to weigh in at a press conference. What we saw in many other states was they took steps to address it that involved COVID shots. They involved masks. They involved separation, Whatley said per the Newsweek Observer. Certainly, we did not call in any way for there to be a release of prisoners, let alone 4,200 of them, including the worst of the worst with pedophiles and predators and rapists and murderers. Cooper, in turn, accused his opponent of being hypocritical. It's pretty clear that he made this COVID release the center of his political attack, but he's been caught lying about it again and again, he said at an event on July 13th. Emancipate NC attorney Elizabeth Simpson said state officials, including Cooper, fought their virus mitigation efforts every step of the way. It was an extremely adversarial litigation. Prison officials also said they were already trying to ease prison overcrowding before the suit, accelerating parole for some people serving life sentences under a previous sentencing structure, sentencing qualified inmates to house arrest, and awarding discretionary credits to shave time off inmates who they felt posed little risk to public safety. North Carolina was not alone in this effort. In October 2020, a California appellate court ordered the release or transfer of 1,700 inmates out of San Quentin State Prison. A month later, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy signed an executive order to release more than 2,000. But they weren't working fast enough for advocates or for the judge. His July 2020 ruling, Rozier wrote that he was extremely concerned by the apparent indifference of state officials. He said officials had failed to provide him sufficient information about what they were doing to combat the virus, and that they had not complied with his orders to stop transfers of inmates between facilities. He also said state officials had failed to make other changes to prevent the spread. Over the next several months, the advocacy groups and state officials haggled over whether the state was complying with the court's orders. The case appeared to be headed to trial. In December 2020, Rozier appointed Thomas Maher, M-A-H-A-E-R, then executive director of Duke's Wilson Center for Science and Justice, to ensure that state officials followed his orders. 2 months later, the parties decided to settle. Rather than reducing the prison population by 18,000 inmates, as the advocacy groups initially sought, the settlement agreement required the state to lower it by at least 3,500 within 6 months, putting the agreement into practice. The Cooper administration used three primary criteria to move people out of prisons. One was to identify nonviolent offenders who met at least one of the prison system's mandatory criteria, such as being 65 or older, and let them serve the remainder of their sentences under house arrest. A second method was awarding credits to reduce inmates' time so they could get out as close to their minimum sentence release date as possible. The inmates could earn credits through good behavior or by participating in certain programs. In many cases, the inmates who were awarded these credits were just a few months shy of hitting their minimum sentences. In the sample of 1,180 inmates that the Sentencing Commission reviewed, 61% were released through this criteria. Officials also accelerated parole for inmates who received life or longer active sentences for crimes committed between 1981 and 1994, when state legislators eliminated parole. The settlement allowed state officials to parole these inmates if they were medically vulnerable, had participated in a structured reentry program, and were expected to pose a low risk to public safety. State prison officials also looked at people who had already completed their sentences but had been flagged for violating post-release supervision in order to determine who should be sent back to prison and who could continue on supervision. Typically, supervised release lasts for 9 to 12 months. If someone violates the terms of their release, they can be sent back to prison for the remainder of the period. If the violation was a new crime, they may be resentenced separately. From available records, it's difficult to tell exactly how long any of these people might have remained back in prison, but those who were allowed to remain on post-release supervision due to settlement appear to be largely people with technical violations, like missing a check-in. Those cases accounted for 34% of the names on the settlement agreement list. The Sentencing Policy Advisory Commission's analysis of an 1,180 inmate sample from the full list concluded that 89% had been let out fewer than 3 months before their projected release date. Nearly half had been convicted of nonviolent, low-level felonies, which typically come with a sentence of less than a year. Another 37% were convicted of mid-level felonies, offenses such as child abuse, assault with a deadly weapon, and habitual impaired driving. The remaining 16% had been convicted of serious felonies, such as second-degree murder, rape, armed robbery, and large-scale drug trafficking, but were approaching release dates set well in advance of the agreement. The difference in recidivism rates was clustered in the latter subgroup. 51% were rearrested within 2 years, compared with 31% of those in that same category released under normal circumstances. But that does not mean they were rearrested for violent crimes, nor does it reflect whether they were ultimately convicted on those charges. I've run out of time for this week's Vision News. I hope you enjoyed listening. There was a lot of factual and statistical stuff in that last article. Please join us next week. I'm Doris Hyde, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Vision News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.